Welcome, everyone, to The Surfing Historian. I'm your host, Jason Old, historian, surfer, and world traveler. This podcast is dedicated to highlighting some of the latest scholarly research in the social sciences and in the field of surf studies. So paddle out with us while we glide through the world of academia. Joining me today from Connecticut is my friend and colleague, Dr. Aaron Lewis. Aaron's a historian of the U.S. South, and today he'll be talking to us about his research on Confederate cultural memory. I'm super stoked to have you on to share your work with our listeners, because it seems like much of your research is still relevant today in 2021. But before we get started, I want to personally thank you and our listeners for being part of this episode of The Surfing Historian.
Yeah, thanks, Jason. Happy to be here. This is—I think I've lost count of how many times that we've had these sort of conversations, but it's nice to have it kind of on an official podcast now. We're finally getting things rolling, getting everything off the ground. So, I'm here to talk about sort of my dissertation research. You mentioned it; it's Confederate cultural memory. So, basically, you know, what I did—the best way I can describe it as—is sort of a case study where I take three influential figures from the Confederacy. I take President Jefferson Davis, and then two Confederate generals, Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. And basically, I examine how their memories changed over the course of about, trying to do math in my head, I'm a historian, not a mathematician, so maybe 70 or so years. And I think it might be good to give a quick background on what historical memory is in case some people are not too up on that. So historical memory, the best way I describe it and the way I describe it to my students is if history is sort of thinking about what happened, creating like a narrative, creating almost a story of what's happening, and that's history, memory is going back in time and picking maybe a specific group or a specific person, or even like a country or a culture, and looking and examining how they remembered something happening. So in the case of my research, I'm not just kind of talking about, you know, what did Lee do after the war, and then there's 60 or so years still left in the dissertation about with him having already died. And so what I'm looking at is not just what happened to him, but it's how did people come to remember him? How did they portray him? Was he portrayed as, you know, this great hero for the Confederacy? Was he eventually, you know, painted as a villain? You know, how did people represent him in their writing or their songs or their poems or their paintings or sculptures, things like that? And so that's sort of what I'm looking at. It's the ways in which Southern culture and specifically white and black Southerners remembered these three influential people, because it is going to change. It changes, you know, pretty drastically, or not changes. It differs drastically between, you know, white Southerners and black Southerners. And for Davis, especially, it does change. He's initially, you know, seen as the villain. He's the reason the Confederacy lost the war. But eventually he becomes to be one of their greatest champions. They revere him nearly as much as they do Robert E. Lee, who has almost universal adulation. Really up until about 40 years ago, he was universally loved, by people in the United States. And so that's sort of the kind of gist of what I was doing. I guess I can go back to sort of what kind of brought me into this is I had a master's thesis, and it was really kind of a true military history with just a little bit of memory studies rolled into it. And the funny thing is I actually didn't know what memory studies was at that point. I sort of just kind of went off my own because, the university I was at, we had a great history department. We didn't really have anybody that was familiar with memory studies to the point that they could sort of direct this master's thesis. So, you know, I had a great mentor there. And so I wrote what was more akin to sort of like a military history of the Civil War. I basically took three specific battles and I reassessed them. And I showed that, you know, Lee deserved less credit than he received. His corps commanders should receive more credit than they deserve. For both the victories and defeats in those three battles, I think they were Antietam, Chancellorsville, and Gettysburg. And so that kind of got me into, at least I definitely wanted to study Confederate culture. I wanted to study, especially because having grown up in Ohio, I still saw a number of Confederate battle flags. Well, not Confederate battle flags. What's become the Confederate flag, flying behind people's trucks, flying in people's yards. And I just, I couldn't really understand why that was the case. And so when I got into the PhD program, I kind of stayed with that idea. I had a general sense of, okay, I want to do something with the South. I want to do something with the Confederacy, because I've always loved the Civil War. I've always been fascinated by it. And I came across a photo of Stone Mountain from Georgia. And if you're not familiar with Stone Mountain, it's this just, it's this massive mountain that has a gigantic carving of three Confederate heroes in it: Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee, and Stonewall Jackson. And outside of the fact that I thought, wow, that seems very overcompensating, creating an entire mountain monument to these guys, I started to ask, okay, why them? Being familiar with the Civil War like I am, I knew there was plenty of other politicians. There was plenty of other military officers that they could have put on there. People really loved Albert Sidney Johnston before he died, just as an example. And so I began to think, you know, why these three guys? And my dissertation director, Dr. Steve Prince, he sort of had me run with that idea. And he had me get really kind of deeply involved in memory studies. He had me read Maurice Halbwach's book, among other things, and really start to dive into the idea of memory studies, because I really had no background in it. So I did, I guess for lack of a better term, and other grad students will understand, a crash course in something that your dissertation was going to encompass, which probably wasn't the best idea, but it definitely worked out. So I started rolling with that. I became really, really kind of embroiled in this topic. I'm sure my wife has heard way too much about this, more than she ever expected to hear about this topic, because it is one I'm really, really passionate about. I think it was very fitting that I got into this sort of thing when I did, because I began my PhD program in 2016. The Confederate monument crisis around the U.S. was beginning. Or was right around that time, which also did motivate me as well. At USF, they have a great 3D printing and digital scanning department, the Digital Heritage Humanities Collection. And I worked there for a number of years. And two of the things that they scanned was the Orlando Confederate Monument at Lake Eola Park and the Tampa Confederate Monument at the Tampa Courthouse. And so I was involved in... I'm not a scanner, but I was there as the researcher and sort of part of the historical writer. And so I was really deeply involved with getting these monuments scanned and kind of put out to the public so people could understand their true meanings, what they were about. And so since they were Confederate monuments, that sort of then strengthened my resolve to really start to continue the unraveling of what was the Confederacy about? What was the true meaning of it? Because the great thing is the last 20 years or so, there has been a resurgence in kind of reshaping or I guess redefining the meaning of the Civil War and the meaning behind the Confederacy's existence, which we now have come to know it is purely slavery. If you look at the secession documents, the documents that were written by the Southern states that declared why they were seceding from the United States, it was over slavery. They wanted to keep their slaves. And so when you look at these monuments, you find that although they're usually very generic, they're of, you know, maybe a soldier. Sometimes it's like a soldier who's got a really nice uniform. He's got his cartridge box and his rifle on one side. And then the other side, it's maybe he's all battle torn and ravaged and everything. And it says something along the lines of, you know, we erect this monument to commemorate the brave men who fought for their ideals. It's very vague. And it's sort of intentional that it's that vague, because they're symbols. And if you go and look at the dedication ceremonies and the speeches that you hear at these monument dedication ceremonies, oftentimes, and I would say nearly all of the times, there is some sort of racial superiority or white supremacy message in that speech. I forget the exact monument and who said it. I believe it was James Kemper, who was a Confederate general, became governor of Virginia. And they blatantly stated, you know, these statues are erected to serve as physical reminders of, you know, white man's superiority over the black man. And I'm paraphrasing that, but this is generally the idea that they were putting forth. And so it was because of this, again, I felt sort of obligated and I felt like it was my duty as a historian to show the public, you know, what are the true meanings behind these monuments? Whereas I think for most people, they look at those monuments and say, oh, look at, you know, they're honoring the soldiers. And they were to a certain degree, but there are also other meanings. I actually owe a great deal of gratitude to Dr. Antoinette Jackson at USF, who's in the anthropology department. I took this great heritage tourism class. So we looked at all, you know, what are kind of the racial and imperialistic implications of people touring in other countries or taking vacations in other countries. And I focused on the Confederate monuments because we were also talking about sort of the meaning behind things. We were talking about, you know, the physical landscape, the fact that physical objects or physical geography cannot speak for itself. And the same applied to these monuments. The fact that these monuments just are sitting sort of in the public space, they can't speak for themselves. And so their meanings can get changed. And I think that was the real key to these monuments for white Southerners who were very good at sort of getting their message across without blatantly showing their message, basically not showing their cards and putting them on the table. They did a great job at having these massive monuments overlooking African-Americans who might've walked by them. On the outside, it's honoring the soldiers, but on the inside, it's still, you know, kind of making sure African-Americans know their place as the lower rungs of society, literally as marble statues, sort of white statues looking down upon and, you know, towering over African-Americans in the South. And I realize I've gotten a bit on a tangent, and this ended up not being a chapter of my dissertation, frankly, because I just didn't have the time. And with the kind of the political implications, as we've all come to know, it seemed a little too hot and a little too dangerous without job security, still being, you know, just a PhD student. It's something I'd certainly like to explore in the future. Frankly, I think you could write an entire book or two right now just about this monument controversy, you know, whether or not we should get rid of the monuments, whether we should keep them up, whether we should clarify their meanings. And there's no real good answer. And I think that's the difficulty. And another reason why I didn't really tackle this in my dissertation is there's no clear answer to it.
You know, you can look at, I think it's Mississippi, and you can certainly correct me if I'm wrong. And the listeners can certainly fact check us as well. But I believe at some point in those documents, it refers to slaves as it, like property. And we all very well know that slaves were effectively property leading up to emancipation. So are you familiar with any of that type of language where it's saying, you know, where it uses the word it to refer to slaves as opposed, in other words, it dehumanizes them?
Did you hear that? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like. Exco, give it to you. How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Beosonic sound experience. That's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it? Let's go, give it to you. Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S. Order now at Acura.com.
En Mayo Clinic de Florida predecimos lo impredecible con órganos impresos en 3D para planificar cirugías complejas. Obtén más información en mayoclinic.org/posible. Mayo Clinic, sabes a dónde ir.
I mean, it's been a number of years since I've read the secession documents. There's actually a really great book, Apostles of Disunion, which it's a short book, but it does a great job at basically breaking down the specific language of the secession documents. I mean, it's one of those books where if you really want to sort of show somebody who's on the fence about, you know, what was secession really about, that's a great book for them to read. It's only like 100 maybe 100 pages. It's a very short book. I'm not certain of the exact terminology or the exact language, but it would not at all surprise me. Because if you look back to the Dred Scott decision, for example, that led up to the Civil War, Dred Scott, as the final verdict from the Supreme Court, they said that Scott couldn't even sue for his freedom legally because he was still considered a piece of property. I think they likened it to whether it would be like a chair or a table trying to sue somebody in court, which of course is horrifying now to think of because it's literally a human being, but legally, you know, it would be akin to having a piece of furniture try to sue you in court. It would not surprise me. I would like our fact checkers to go through and see, but it would not at all surprise me if it made like an it or even like a they or a them, which could refer to people. It could also refer to, you know, go get the plates and set them on the table, for example. And so that's the sort of language I would expect in the documents. I don't know for sure, and I don't want to give, you know, the wrong answer, but given how white Southerners typically viewed slaves and just slavery as a whole, it wouldn't surprise me if they used that sort of language that you would use for basically everyday household objects, because legally that's what they considered these enslaved people to be.
Yeah, it's pretty striking when you think about that. And so I'm going to bring you back to something that you've studied extensively, and something we started the top of the episode off with, the Confederate flag and the monuments. And you've talked about obviously your work in memory studies and all of that. And so, can you? I have a couple of questions for you. When did these monuments go up? And why? You know, I think you addressed the why, but, you know, so that we can, for the listener, contextualize it or historically contextualize it. Can you help us understand when these monuments went up? If you don't mind, maybe speak a little bit about what we now call the Confederate flag, and how did it become so popularized after the Civil War?
Sure. Yeah. So to start off with the monuments, I guess not just monuments, but memorialization of the Confederacy and people who served in the Confederate military. That stuff was going on even in the war. There's a great book by Carolyn Janney about ladies' memorial associations, and they were basically groups of women, especially in Virginia. I think that's where it started, where they would, you know, set up cemeteries specifically for the Confederate dead. They would even go so far as to sometimes, you know, disinter them from battlefields and give them a final resting place. So that was sort of the initial memorialization movement for Confederate soldiers and just people associated with the Confederacy. And I mean, the monuments started going up not really until like the 1870s, 1880s, that's when they were really starting to become a fashion thing, which tended to coincide with the onset of Jim Crow. I mean, granted, Jim Crow started in 1865, pretty much as soon as Reconstruction started, but it really picks up steam with, you know, the redemption of the South taking hold in the early 1870s. And so it's the 1870s and 1880s where we start to see these Confederate monuments really, you know, litter the Confederate landscape, and even places in the North too. And that's a testament to, you know, sort of covering up the true meaning of them. One of our colleagues, Doug Benner, he always used to sort of chime in with the story about there was a town in Minnesota that he visited that has a Confederate statue in it, and the town was founded after the Civil War. So, you know, who are they actually commemorating in this town in Minnesota, which is about as north as you can get when you get up right toward the border of Canada. And so it's again, coming back to those, you know, alternate meanings behind these monuments. But really 1870s, 1880s especially is when we start to see the memorialization. It's a decade or two after the war ends. And then when it comes to the Confederate flags, so there was a number of Confederate flags throughout the war. The one that most people associate with is, you know, the stars and bars, the red background with the blue stripes and the white stars in it. And so that was actually originally square. And that was the one of the Confederate battle flags. So it was a square flag. And then it's actually the Ku Klux Klan who is going to sort of co-opt it. And they sort of stretch it out to make it the rectangular shape that we have now. And they used it for quite a long time. And again, with these physical objects having no real agency and ability to speak for themselves, other people then further took it and sort of used it as just, oh, it's a symbol of rebellion. It's a symbol of, you know, I don't believe what maybe the government is doing. I don't want to associate with them. I'm a rebel. Or, you know, I think people are doing things that they shouldn't, and I want to rebel from them. So it's more of a kind of a symbol of individualism or rebellion now. And I think that's a lot of the, I think I would say a lot of people in the United States probably more closely associated with it rather than the Confederate flag itself. I would say at the very least, people in the North who are flying it are more than likely viewing it as just a sort of symbol of rebellion. You know, and the spirit of the Confederacy is still very much alive in the South. As we've heard in the news, in the current events lately. But generally, yeah, the departure from Confederate military flag to sort of flag of white supremacy was primarily via when the Ku Klux Klan sort of took this flag and made it their own.
Are you familiar with when the Klan actually was, I guess we'd say founded? When was that, shortly after the Civil War?
Yeah, they were founded quite short after. So they're officially disbanded in, I believe it's 1871, by like an executive order from then President Ulysses S. Grant. But they were around for a few years, and they were formed pretty soon after the Civil War. There's really about three iterations of the Ku Klux Klan. There's like three kind of groups of them. There's the one that was founded right after the Civil War, existed through the first part of Reconstruction. Eventually, they, like I said, they were disbanded via executive order. Then they start to pop up again in the 19-teens, especially after the release of D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, which portrayed the Klan as, you know, these heroic defenders of Southern morality and everything that's right with the South, and defenders of white supremacy. And so they lasted for a number of years following that, and even into the 1920s as the another anti-immigration wave gripped the U.S. And then again, with the civil rights, the modern civil rights era of the 1950s and 1960s, we see what's basically the third iteration of the KKK. So there's been a number of sort of different groups, and really they've grown more powerful and influential each time. It's the second Ku Klux Klan of the 19 teens that you start to really see like nationwide membership. I think even the northern states like Indiana had many members in the National Ku Klux Klan, whereas the first one in the 1860s and 1870s, that was primarily a Southern phenomenon, because their goal was to prevent African Americans and Republicans from taking over in the South. And that was really their main goal.
Okay, interesting. I'm trying to stay on topic, but you know, like I said, every time we talk, there's something new I personally want to ask you. And so I'm sure the viewers are, or the listeners, I should say, are thinking the same thing. And so you mentioned a movie, I think it came out, and correct me if I'm wrong, 1915, mm-hmm. The Birth of a Nation. And so you said at that time the Klan sort of resurfaced or became more empowered. I don't know what the right word would be when it comes to that. But are you familiar with the, I believe they did another, The Birth of a Nation in 2016. Did you see the second one, or can you, are you familiar with the second one, or do you feel more comfortable just telling us a bit about the 1915 version and why that would mean so much or be so significant for the Klan?
So I have not seen the new one. So of course I don't want to speculate on anything about it. But yeah, I can definitely tell you more about the 1915 version. So the 1915 Birth of a Nation was at the time basically one of the greatest cinematic accomplishments in history. It's a silent movie. It's in black and white. I think it's about 3 hours long. I mean, it's a very, very long movie. At the time, I think it cost a dime to get in, which would be akin to paying, I think, $25 or $35 now just for a movie ticket. I mean, it was abnormally expensive, but it was also immensely popular. And the general plot, and it's broken up into like three different acts. I'm not going to get into it for the sake of all our listeners, but it follows two families, one in the South and one in the North. And really the biggest takeaway from it is it shows that the movie demonstrates that, you know, African-Americans, Republicans, carpetbaggers were all sort of destroying the South. I remember there's one notable scene towards the end of the film where this town in the South is overrun by Union soldiers, especially African-American Union soldiers. And they're portrayed as, you know, looting the place, having their way with the Southern white women. And then it's the Klan that sort of rides in on their horses. They're able to chase everybody away. People greet them as, you know, like these great saviors. And so it made it seem as though, you know, the Klan was this noble force doing good. And then it also didn't help that then President Woodrow Wilson screened it in the White House and effectively gave it, you know, his stamp of approval, approval, which then made even more people think like, wow, if the president is approving this, then maybe there is actually some fact to it. This is something that we should believe. And it's not unsurprising because, I mean, up until then, despite all the legislative work of Reconstruction largely didn't happen. African Americans were still second-class citizens in the South. So it really just sort of reinforced what people might have actually believed already. And so, as we know, pop culture is hugely influential in the US. And so to have this, you know, this massive achievement of a movie then endorsed by Woodrow Wilson, that was sort of it tugged on the tropes of, you know, the heroic people saving those that are, you know, less fortunate or less able to themselves. It led to a lot of people really identifying with this movie. And it really just reinforced all of these white supremacist notions that had been existing. I mean, really at that point for hundreds of years. And so that's one reason why it was so immensely popular. And then of course it gave the Klan more reason to sort of resurge because people saw the heroic, I of course use that in quotation marks, deeds of the Klan in the movie. And they thought, okay, this is, you know, maybe this is what we should be doing. This is who we should be joining with. And at that time too, there was the first Red Scare was going to be happening soon. There was another wave of immigrants in the US. And so there was this fear again of protecting sort of the Americanness of the United States. And so the Klan was predicated on keeping, you know, America white. And so I think a lot more people also joined up because it was like protecting their way of life, protecting their white values. And it was really just kind of a perfect storm, I think, of kind of reinvigorating white supremacy more than it already was just by itself.
It really sounds like as a film, it in effect romanticized the Klan. And so which was, I think you mentioned Grant and the executive order. I think it was the Ku Klux Klan Act that effectively labeled the Klan as a terror organization. So, you know, you mentioned we kind of jumped into the 19-teens and skipped over, I think, something that is not only important for the listeners, but important for it's part of your research. And so you used the word Reconstruction, and you know, it's hard to understand Reconstruction without understanding a lot of the things you'd already talked about with the Civil War and things like that. And so can you help us understand what Reconstruction was? And then you also used the term redemption of the South. And you know, what is that? What is the redemption of the
That? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like. Next, don't give it to you. How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Beosonic sound experience. And that's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it? Next, don't give it to you. Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S. Give up. Order now at Acura.com.
En Mayo Clinic de Florida predecimos lo impredecible. Según la anatomía del paciente, creamos modelos tridimensionales de los órganos para prever dificultades y hacer que una cirugía compleja sea más precisa, eficaz y menos invasiva. En Mayo Clinic logramos más. Todos los días hacemos lo que nunca se ha hecho. Obtén más información en mayoclinic.org/posible. Mayo Clinic, sabes a dónde ir.
South.
So what is reconstruction and redemption? Boy, how much time do you got? Probably too much time for our listeners, so I'll try to boil it down a little bit. So in short, reconstruction, at least in the eyes of the radical Republicans, was the complete reshaping of Southern economy, society, and culture, basically trying to rid the South of its white supremacy, of slavery, sort of remake them into the part of the country that the other half, the North, could be proud of. I refer to this, I know in our lectures, I always bring this up, is the South at this point was incredibly far behind when it came to technology and sort of advancement. When the Tennessee Valley Authority in the 1930s brings electricity to most of the South, that was the first time that most of the South had electricity in the 1930s. So it took a long time for the South to come back. So in Reconstruction in 1865, and it goes till about 1876, 1877, it's this battle actually, not between necessarily the South and North, but even people within the North who want to either remold and reshape the South completely, and then those who simply want to restore it back into the North, basically not change anything. The latter of which was primarily President Andrew Johnson, who took over after Lincoln. And so the radical Republicans and Johnson butted heads over whether they should completely reshape the South or if they just want to basically get them back in the Union as quick as possible. There was a little bit of both. You know, we get the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments ratified, which gives, you know, it outlaws slavery. It gives citizenship rights to African Americans. It gives voting rights to African Americans. But eventually you get the idea in the South of redemption. And so to go back just a little bit, what Johnson was fine with was former Confederates and white supremacists, prominent leaders of the Confederacy, being able to hold public office in the South. And so, I mean, what do you think happens when you allow this to happen? I mean, things are going to go back to the way they were because these guys are not just going to magically change their minds. And so by allowing that to happen, a lot of these states go back to the same way they were before the Civil War. Granted, they can't have slavery, but they certainly tried to find workarounds to that. So when a state was redeemed, it means that white supremacists or Democrats were back in control of the state legislature. You know, they were they controlled the governorship, and then they sent representatives to Congress. So basically, all of the political power of the state was back in the hands of the people who had more than likely supported the South's secession during the Civil War and who had served with the Confederacy in some capacity. And so the final redemption of the South was the 1876 presidential election. Rutherford B. Hayes was the Republican candidate. And there was a very, very close race in South Carolina. I'm trying for the, I can never remember the one state. And then shockingly, or maybe unsurprisingly, Florida was a very close vote for a presidential election. Who would have ever guessed? And so there was such a tight vote that the Southern states said, hey, you can have the presidency if you allow us to have the governorships of those three states in favor of the Democrats. And so Reconstruction had already been incredibly difficult. You had groups like the Klan committing, you know, acts of political violence, of political terrorism. And frankly, a lot of people in the North were just were tired of it. And so they gave them the presidency. They gave the Republicans the presidency, and they let the Southern states have the Democratic candidates. And so the redemption of the South was complete. The South was back in the hands of white supremacists and Democrats. And so that was really just the end of Reconstruction.
Okay, great. I'm sitting here writing things as you're talking just because, you know, there's just so many follow-up questions. I think we're running short on time, but I guess in sum, you know, with the redemption of the South, is it fair to say that that is in and around the time that the Jim Crow era starts. Is it fair to say something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely say so. So the Jim Crow era, I mean, it's really a very, very long era. It really starts to take hold in the 1870s. And so it's the early 1870s that you see many of these Southern states starting to become redeemed. What happens is typically the Klan would go and terrorize or even kill Black voters to prevent them from voting in elections. It would drive Republican votes and Republican numbers down to the point that Democrats were almost guaranteed to win the election. And so that's how they were able to influence things. And I think especially without the Klan, redemption would not have been successful, or it would have been much more painstaking. But I mean, really, Jim Crow lasts until the end of the modern civil rights movement. You know, they're officially done then, but unofficially, I mean, there are still aspects of our society even today that aren't necessarily molded in the same way as Jim Crow, but they certainly have similar sort of discrimination or discriminatory air about them. But to go back, it's the 1870s that you really start to get the Jim Crow laws big, you know, largely in effect, which unsurprisingly is around the time that the Ku Klux Klan is finishing sort of its reign of terror in the South. But there are other groups that take over after the Klan too. So they also coincide.
And so that brings me to the last question I have for you. And, you know, your research is really about events that happened, you know, approximately 150 years ago. Again, I'm a historian as well, not a mathematician. So we'll just say 150 years ago. But, you know, my question for you is what makes it relevant today? Why is your research relevant and, you know, you know, how are you contributing, I guess, in helping understand what happened back then and helping make sense of events that are going on in recent past?
So I always say that, you know, to understand the present and the future, you have to understand the past, because as we've seen, even just, you know, these last 4 or 5 years, you know, things are repeating themselves, albeit there are things slightly different, but we're still seeing issues, especially of race and sort of a racially structured society, becoming a real problem. And obviously, there was a war fought over slavery and the issue of race. And so with Reconstruction failing, with white Southerners being allowed to reclaim their place, or rather white supremacists being able to reclaim their place in the South, you know, slavery and race, I know you can't just, you know, snap your fingers and have it be done, but there was a great disservice done to try to, there was a lack of effort in trying to kind of rebalance or, you know, create equality in the United States. And so I think when it comes to the history of the Confederacy and the memory of the Confederacy, since so many of these memories are wrapped up also in the perpetuation of white supremacy, you know, these people were trying to say, oh, you know, remember the Confederacy, we fought for our rights, we fought for our beliefs. Well, you know, I'm sorry to say, but those beliefs and those rights are firmly rooted in white supremacy and their belief that African Americans were, you know, lower than them. And so allowing that idea to fester, to basically, you know, abandon Reconstruction and in a sense abandon African Americans to the will of white Southerners in the South, it's important to understand, because as we've seen from current events, there are still huge disparities in how different, you know, people of different races are treated in the U.S. And I think that can be traced back to this continual, adherence of white supremacy throughout the United States. It's not just a Southern phenomenon. We saw that in the 20th century. I mean, white supremacy pervaded the entire United States. And so I think for me, I talked, you know, a decent amount of white supremacy, because you cannot talk about the Civil War without talking about it. It would be like talking about World War II and not mentioning Hitler being aggressive. It's impossible to talk about. And so I think that's where I'd like to leave it, without getting too much into, you know, current events and politics. It's still very raw for people. But that's where I'd leave it. It is the continuing problems of disparities between race existed back then and exist now. We're not dealing with necessarily slavery, but we are still dealing with differences in how people of different races are being treated. And so I think my work is just a very small drop in the bucket of what other people have been doing. But I think at the same time, I want my work to be able to contribute to the you know, evolution of racial equality and harmony in American society. And so I hope that that's how it comes about. And I think eventually when I start to turn this into a book, that's sort of the direction it's going to turn. As I move toward, you know, the middle of the 20th century and the modern civil rights movement, you know, how does the memory of the Confederacy matter in the 1960s? And then on after the civil rights movement is, you know, quote unquote, over, and there's supposed to be equality in the United States. How is the memory of the Confederacy still alive? How are the ideals of white supremacy still kind of lurking beneath the surface of, for example, a show like The Dukes of Hazzard has a car named the General Lee and has a Confederate flag painted on the outside? You know, how do these images of the Confederacy still matter? And so I guess that's where I'd like to leave it at this point.
You know, I appreciate, you know, first and foremost, you know, your work, your contribution, and, you know, just sort of a, almost like a concluding thought, or I would even call this an afterthought, you know, as you're talking about your research and memory studies and the Confederacy and the flag and, you know, how it's in effect tied to Southern identity. What I found somewhat interesting and even intriguing is that in the South, you have this surfer identity, Southern identity, and all of that sort of, you know, sort of comes together in a really interesting way. And what I mean by that is, you know, when you look at places like, you know, for example, where I grew up around Virginia Beach and have family and friends in the Outer Banks. And of course, you know, being down here in Florida, you see surfers actually, Southern surfers brandishing the Confederate flag. And so I think in an interesting way, sort of the rebellious nature of surfers, they've tied the Confederate flag into their identity, is where I'm going with that. And, you know, I find that quite intriguing. And it's as you said at the, you know, more or less at the top of the show, you know, the use of this flag by many is, you know, sort of a statement of a rebellious nature, not necessarily this tie, quote unquote, to white supremacy. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And one thing I wanted to state is that I hope nobody misinterprets what I'm saying. I wouldn't in any way argue that, you know, generalize that white supremacy is just alive in the South. You know, if you're in the South, I'm not saying that you're a white supremacist at all. What we're talking about and what I want to get across is, like you just put, is that using the flag, you know, even unintentionally, you see it as a flag of rebellion. But when it comes down to it, the original meaning of it was the idea of white supremacy. But like I want to reemphasize, just because you are using that does not mean that you use those initial meanings. You've created your own meaning for it. And I think that's why it's so important to study them, is to get these different perspectives on it. And I think that can be also one of the problems of doing history, and even especially just in current events right now, is the generalization of many groups just saying, you know, oh, all Southerners are racist. No, it's not true. That's just, you know, they're not all white supremacists. It's just not a thing. And I guess that's another thing that I think in my writing I tried to get across, was that, you know, I'm not trying to blanket define anybody, because we've seen that, I think, in the last 4 years on, you know, certain sides of the political spectrum. We've seen this generalization of, you know, everybody is this. And that's just not the case. And that's why it's so important for historians to kind of write in a certain way and research in a certain way to show that there are, of course, going to be differences.
Yeah, I find that intriguing. And I'm really grateful that you've taken the time to help at least me better understand the history behind a lot of what is still alive and well to a certain extent today. And so your work is extremely relevant. And, you know, I'm looking forward to that book, by the way. And so I'm going to leave you with the last word. And I just want to thank you for being part of the Surfing Historian. And again, this is a good buddy of mine and colleague, Dr. Aaron Lewis. You get the last word.
Oh boy, last word, the pressure's on. I feel like I've said so much already. I'm sure you all are probably sick of it by now. First of all, I appreciate you having me on, Jason. I always enjoy our conversations. I feel like we always have a plan and then we just end up going in these different directions because it's sort of whatever that day we're sort of interested in or certain maybe words or topics that just like hit these buttons and we get off on these tangents. And I feel like we so got off on a tangent today, but I think it was great because I hope that people were able to kind of get a history lesson today and we're hopefully a little entertained. But I had a great time coming on, talking about my research. But above all, I just hope that, you know, whoever's listening, understands, you know, the importance of studying history, the importance of looking back and trying to connect things from past to present. Because in a way, nothing is truly ever gone. It might, you know, be laying dormant. It might be laying in a piece of, you know, in an artifact or a book laying around somewhere. But it's so important for us to make sure that we look up and study as much as we can about history, because I think it could really, really inform us about sort of what we should do going forward in the future. And that's me sort of stepping off my pedestal.
If you found the themes Aaron and I just discussed in this episode intriguing, be sure to check out the next episode where my friend Dr. Arwin Puteri, a historian of contemporary Europe, talks about a cultural and social divide that manifested itself in another part of the world, albeit for different reasons. She'll be joining me to talk about her research on the social unity in Germany amongst East and West Germans. You won't want to miss this fascinating episode. This has been another episode of The Surfing Historian. I'm your host, Jason Old. Be sure to share, like, and subscribe to never miss an episode. Again, thanks for listening, and until next time, stay stoked.